that's part of what makes it sweeter, is just like, you're like, wow, I did a really hard thing.
This is Heart of the Story, and I'm Nadine Kenny Johnstone. I'm an author and a holistic writing coach who talks with today's top women writers about how to navigate life when things don't go according to plan. These impactful conversations and personal reflections invite you to be seen, feel supported, and ultimately fall back in love with yourself. So let's go together to that honest, powerful place, the heart of the story. Hi, friends. I know that Mother's Day can be a complicated day for many people. It might be very happy, very sad, or both. And that's why I thought that today's guest, Betsy Armstrong, the author of the brand new book, The Mother of All Decisions, would be the perfect person to talk to, because we see her own journey included a lot of high highs and low lows. And in this conversation, we talk about the impact that her mother's passing had on her. Her mother passed away from colon cancer when Betsy was 23 and her mother was 46. And it left a lasting impact on Betsy, so much so that she did not think she wanted to have children. And then when she turned 47 and realized she had lived longer than her mother had, maybe she would continue living a long life. And she started rethinking her perspective about parenting, which started her on an adoption journey, which was really, really beautiful. And we talk about all of that in this interview. In particular, this is a really important conversation to me because I helped coach Betsy on her manuscript. And so to see it out in the world as a book that readers can hold in their very own hands is just an absolute delight. I think that you're going to love our chat because we talk about what it's like to have a really, really hard past, but still hold on to hope and still approach something with all you have, with all the optimism and courage and fear that you might have, but how to traverse the future even when your past has been a really, really hard one. Her story is one of incredible perseverance that will inspire you for sure. I think you'll love this conversation and I can't wait to dive in. Before I do, I wanted to remind you that this Tuesday, Melanie Brooks, another former podcast guest, and I are going to be leading our masterclass all about publishing your stories. We'll be talking about the different routes to publishing, all the pros and cons. And between the two of us and all the people we've coached, we have a vast array of experience in all different avenues of publishing. And so we'll have an open and honest conversation about what these different paths are and how you can get your words out into the world. It will be on Zoom on Tuesday, May 13th. And if you cannot make it, you can always sign up and we will send you the replay afterwards. You can find out more at nadinekennyjohnstone.com/classes or find the link in the show notes. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Betsy Armstrong. Welcome to the show, Betsy.
Hi, Nadine. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here, getting a chance to chat with you. It's so awesome.
Well, for listeners, you may not know this, but Betsy's already been on the show before a couple of years ago, and we worked together on this manuscript years ago, and it is a joy to see it as a book that I can hold in my hands and that is going out into the world to impact so many people. And I am beyond thrilled for you that your book is out in the world now.
Well, it would never have happened without you, Nadine, because I can't think of anybody who would have taken, as I say, the horrible mishmash I called a manuscript with all these random things in it, like almost 500 pages of randomness, maybe some good writing. And you read the whole thing and you're like, yep, we can make this into a book. Okay, let's go. And that was in like, what, 2017, 2018?
Yeah, I think around 2018. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing about you. I truly think with everything you do, there is perseverance and commitment, whether it was your running career, how you are as a parent, how you are in everything you do not give up, my friend.
I've been told that before. I've been told by many people, like, you know, you don't have to do it at 200%. It can be 100%. It can be 50%. And sometimes that works better for the long run. So, yeah. But I tend to go about things at 200%. And then I slam myself into a wall and have to rest a little bit before I get up and keep going. But
yeah,
I think perseverance is definitely a theme in my life.
Well, what I love about your book is that you tell this story of how at age 47, when you were still a bit ambivalent about whether or not you wanted to have children, you and your husband, Doug, decided to start looking into adoption. And you ended up adopting a brother and sister, Svetlana and Andrei, 11 and 8, from Russia. And so your life looked one way for a while and then looked a completely different way. And I would love for you to take us back to some of the really impactful events that happened in your life, especially when you were 23, that ultimately may have impacted the decision to adopt.
Sure. Good question. So when I was 23 and my mom was 46, she was diagnosed with colon cancer. And this was back in 1987. So it wasn't like we were watching Katie Couric on the Today Show have a colonoscopy. You know, that came way later. Mm-hmm. So I was one of her primary caregivers. And we had some really just terrible, awful, beautiful, heartfelt conversations where my mom talked about when she knew she was terminal, all the things that she wished she could have done in her life that she would never get to do. And to sit with that pain as a 23-year-old and watch my mother, who was just like my person, I was her daughter, like we were a thing, and to watch her be so sad, it just hit me really hard. And the silver lining of that is that it really did make me decide that if there was something I thought I wanted to do, I better do it. I better do it now. I better start. Mm-hmm. And if I never finish, it's because, you know, I didn't last that long. But so far I've lasted this long. And that sort of motivation was what made me run marathons, do triathlons, made me quit my corporate job to go back to grad school to be a counselor and then run a nonprofit. Every time I have a big life decision, I kind of ask myself, am I going to regret this if I don't do it? Mm-hmm. And the answer is almost always yes. Mm-hmm. And so when I was 46, looking at 47, it really hit me that, oh my gosh, I thought I was going to die like my mom did at her age, at 46. Mm. And now I'm going to be 47. Mm-hmm. What in the world am I going to do? Because I was sort of in a very, my body was breaking down. Mm-hmm. So running and, you know, having endurance sports in my life was really getting to be so painful I couldn't do it. The job I had at the time was a charity that focused on running. There was just a lot of emotional things going on with me, just going, what should I do? I'm at this crossroads in my life. Do I want to really push through the hardness of working at this nonprofit and persevere there? Or do I want to do this thing that I never in a million years really thought I'd do? And I was very ambivalent about children, probably as I got older and older. When I was young, I'm pretty sure I told many people that I was never going to be a mom, that I like babies, no, not going to do that. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I'm looking at this age going, wow, I'm not going to die and leave somebody. Mm-hmm. I mean, I will eventually, but just at 47, I don't know. I was just like I had been given a terminal diagnosis.
Yeah.
And then somebody called me and went, oh, we made a mistake. You're fine.
Yes. I think that is a true, real feeling that when we have lost someone close to us at a younger age, then we worry that we too will share that fate. I know that when my father passed away at age 57, I'd always thought of myself as hopefully someone who would live a good long life and paid attention to my health. But something about that 57 marker is kind of blinking in my brain now and adding this sort of worry or urgency that I didn't have before. And so as you talk about with you at age 46 and then finally 47, you make it beyond the point that your mother did. So you have this whole host of emotions, but there's also still this urgency to live the life that you want and to live with impact. And you talk a lot about legacy in your book. What does that word mean to you, and what kind of legacy were you hoping to leave?
Yeah, that's so I think one of the other things, not to keep going back to my mother, but one of the things she asked me to do, she thought our family was her legacy. And first, when she was dying, she asked me, she said, Betsy, will you please try to keep the family together? I know she knew that her second husband, my stepdad, was a difficult person, and yet she hung on to him in spite of a lot of challenges between the two of them. And then she wanted me to keep the family going.
Right.
And when she passed, I found out that my stepdad had helped her change her will to disown me and disinherit me. And so I felt like the legacy that my mom had sort of pinned all her hopes on after she was so sad she couldn't do anything else was this family. And the family just disintegrated.
Yeah.
And for me, honestly, that was a silver lining, you know, Nadine. Like not having to deal with my stepdad was a silver lining in my life. But at the time, I felt so alone and I felt so devastated for not just myself, but my mom. I was like, this isn't fair. This isn't what she wanted. I'll go back to the first marathon because it was the summer after she died. I went out for a run in May, right before Mother's Day. And May is also my mom's birthday month. So May for me can be kind of heavy sometimes. And I went out for this run in the morning. It was a race. So I did this 5-mile race. And then I came back and I just was really sad and melancholy, and I decided to go for another run, which I had never really done that. So I came back home and I felt like I was floating, and I just, the route that I happened to live on and run on was also the route of the Twin Cities Marathon. And so I finished the race and then the run subsequently. And I just, it was in my head, I'm going to run a marathon. If I can run 11 miles in one day, I can do a marathon.
Yes, you can.
And so that summer I trained, and that October when I ran the marathon and actually did it, I remember, you know, coming into the finish line, I had friends there and some family there, and, you know, they're cheering for me and I've got my Mylar blanket, and, but I just felt my mom say to me, Betsy, look at what you did. And if you can do this, what else can you do? And that's the question. It's like, if I can do this, what else can I do? And yes, it's physical, but then it also became something where legacy became more than just me using up my body, which I want to do. Like, I want to use every last muscle and, you know, heartbeat right up till the end. And and so, yeah, it turned into not just the physical part, but also the, what kind of career do I want? What are my values? You know, how can I live a life of intention and purpose and feel like I made the world a little bit better? I guess that's what I really feel. I hope my legacy is in my small way. I'm not pretending that I'm curing cancer or doing something on that grand scale, but on my little scale, it feels like I've had a pretty good run. there's a few people that are better for knowing me. I'll just say that, I think. I hope.
Oh, there are. There are. And Andre and Svetlana are two of those people. So as a new parent, they come home and there's a language barrier and you all have to learn each other and really figure out how to bond. And so what were some of the beautiful and hard moments of those early days after you all were trying to become a new family?
Yeah. There's so many good ones. And then there's also some, you know, just like, what in the world? I think one of my favorite things in the very beginning was the day that they went to American school, like their first school. And it was a Chicago public school, kindergarten through eighth grade. And it was a good one because we, you know, I'm doing that air quotes, good one.
Yeah.
Because we lived in a neighborhood that had a good neighborhood school. And when my husband and I bought that house, we had no intentions of, like,
yeah. You know,
we're like, oh, this will be good for resale value because we're not having kids.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, flash forward. I just remember, like, taking them, you know, and picking out their outfits and taking the picture outside. And they're both like these two little kids from Siberia. I mean, Andre was 12 and he weighed 55 pounds.
Yes.
So that tells you, like, they were little, even though they weren't as young as most people assumed an adopted child would be. And then walking them to school. And this is really crazy. As we were walking down Western Avenue to cross the street with Joan, Miss Joan, the crossing guard, a running friend of mine saw me crossing the street holding their hands. And they just yelled out the window, "Motherhood looks good on you." It was like, oh my God, this is crazy. The very first day. So it just felt like, oh, this is what motherhood is. You know, I'm like getting my kids ready for school and walking them to school. And it's something I'd watched all these people, you know, in Chicago do throughout the years. And the nonprofit I was in, I worked in schools, but I just never had kids at a school. So that was funny. And then I think one story I also love to tell, because it just sort of captures what an anxious, weird, I'm going to call myself, I was weird as a mom. So the day of the first play date, my son, Andre, he made two best friends. Like, right away, the teacher sat him between these two little boys, Dean and Daniel, and Dean, Daniel, and Andre became like the three musketeers. So Dean and Daniel were coming over, and it was a big deal to Andre. It was such a big deal to me that I called the cleaning lady and had the house cleaned for a play date. And then I went on to set up like what you would have at a party for adults, like little bowls of peanuts, but it was, you know, goldfish and crackers and hot Cheetos, because we were going to be the house where all the kids came to eat junk food. I just decided that's how it was going to be. And then they walk in and they're like, "Should we take off our shoes?" I was like, oh my gosh, what is wrong with me? I just had no idea how to relate. Like, oh, they don't care how clean the house is. They just want to run around and play and eat something and, you know, have fun together. But I was so nervous. I had to, you know, get it all set up.
Yeah. Well, I remember, I forget if it was, I think it was Andre, like, you were so determined to help him gain weight, and there was barely anything that he liked, but you started making chocolate chip cookies, if I'm remembering this correctly.
Yes, that
was it. Svetlana or Andre?
It was Andre.
Yeah. And you, once you realize that that's what he liked, you're like, listen, bud, you could have all the cookies in the world.
Yeah, I know. That's right along with the junk food house. But yeah, he was sitting on the couch. I don't know. He was looking at something, maybe watching TV. And I had baked these cookies and I just took one, a warm one, you know, not too hot, but it still was gooey. And I just put it in his mouth. I like put it in front of his nose and he was like, that smells good. And so I just shoved it in there and he was like, oh, mama, more.
Yes. Yes.
It was definitely a moment of like, yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. There's a scene in the book where we figure out, again, I'm using air quotes, that our kids like pizza.
Yes.
Who knew?
Who knew a kid would like pizza? Yes, yes. But in many ways, I think what the book says to me is that you all were learning yourselves and each other at the same time. Because when Andre and Svetlana joined you all, your running career was dissipating because of all the bodily stuff. You were leaving the nonprofit. And so you started a whole new life in many, many ways this very same time as they did. And then you're learning the language of being a mother. And then you all are learning your own language together. That's why I think the book is so beautiful, because you're really showcasing this simultaneous discovery journey that all of you were going on at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. And the way we adopted was kind of interesting, if you want me to go into that a little bit, because we did what's known as a foster to adopt program with international children. So they came to visit us for about 3 weeks. Groups of older orphans would come and stay with host families. We had watched some friends of ours go through this process. And it just seemed to me like, oh, if I'm going to be a mom, this is a great way. I'll get to meet the kids. And they were old enough that they, well, at least Andre, in Russian court, he had to go to court and say he chose us, just like we chose him.
Yes.
And so I just thought it was good for both sides to live with each other. Mm-hmm. And just kind of go, oh, okay, this is where I would live. I mean, I can't imagine what they, you know, I guess I could ask them now, but they don't remember a lot. But it stuns me that they just left everything behind and took our hands, literally took our hands. And we led them out of the orphanage, you know, to Moscow and then the U.S. And what trust.
Yes.
And resilience do they have, the kids? Mm-hmm. And I guess one of the things that I've learned is that I guess I can trust myself a lot more than I thought I could at the time to be a mom and to rise to the challenges of these two kids who are suddenly living with me and could walk out the door at any time, but not know our last name, not know our address, not know my phone number. And so there was a period of just absolute anxiety for me, probably for them too. But yeah, I think there's kind of the honeymoon period, I think, where they're like, oh my gosh, they're buying me toys and clothes. And like everyone's coming and bringing me presents. And I was like, you guys don't have to do that to our friends. One of our friends gave Svetlana 7 Barbie dolls for her first birthday in the U.S. Mm-hmm. I'm like, 7 Barbie dolls? Come on. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Not have to overwhelm them, but we kind of did. It was just really so fun in a way. I mean, I know I was super anxious and we went to so many doctor and dentist and eye appointments and tutors and all of the things, but to come out now, they're 22 and 24 and Andre's trained as an electrician and he's looking for a job. He's had a job, but now he's looking for another one. Mm-hmm. And Svetlana is still figuring it out, which is fair. When you read the book, you'll see I did not have one job that I stayed at for very long.
Yeah.
But I think one of the things I recognize in my kids, and they helped me recognize it in myself, is that bravery of like, okay, I am just going to dive in the deep end. And whether it's, I'm going to run a marathon or I'm going to quit my job and go to grad school, or I'm going to adopt children from Russia. I feel like I just, as we started, kind of go full tilt and just go for it. I have this picture of Andre the first Valentine's Day that he was with us, and he had a Valentine in his fifth grade class that he liked, and he was very adamant that he didn't want to just give her like one of the little Valentine cards. So we go to CVS, you know, where all good Valentine's stuff is. And he picked out this flower that was just really gaudy, but it was what he wanted. I'm like, okay, give her that flower in the green glitter pot and whatever.
Yeah.
So he's marching into school, and he's, like I said, 12 and so little, and he's holding this flower pot for his crush. And I just thought it was, I'm like, what a brave little boy.
Yes.
He wasn't trying to hide the fact that he was doing this or like be, you know, kind of surreptitious about it.
Yes.
No, he just marched right into the school holding this thing. It's like, this is for Emily. Boom. You know? Mm-hmm. And I love that, that I guess all of the hard parts of their early life didn't take that away from them.
Yes.
That they could still have kind of like the optimism and bravery and hope that this next thing they're walking into is going to be better than what they left behind.
Yeah. And someone could say the same about you, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's, I think what I'm trying to express is that, yeah, I feel that for myself too. And I think back sometimes, I'm like, oh my God, how did I move to Chicago and really not know anybody and have a job that I wasn't sure I could even do, but it paid so well. I moved to Chicago for it. Mm-hmm. And I was the first person, first of all, to get a college degree in my family and then to kind of leave Minnesota and go somewhere else and make a life.
Yeah. While dealing with the grief of losing your mom and family just dissipating, all of that. And that's what I think the beauty is in your book. You're showing in Svetlana and Andre and in your story this really hard, traumatic past. And yet, there's so much hope. There's so much optimism. There's so much bravery. And there's so much tenacity moving forward. And I love when you show the adoption scenes, you show all of you choosing each other. And that's what it felt like. There was an instantaneous bond, and just like, we don't know what the future may hold. And the past was really, really hard, but we're going to try. We're going to try this, and we're going to give it all of our might and all of our hope, and we're going to move forward.
Yeah. It was really okay, we're putting all our eggs literally in this basket.
Yeah.
And taking it to Russia. hoping it doesn't turn into an omelet.
Yes.
Yeah, that is it though. And that is part of what I hope when people read the book or read my writing in general, that there is this current of, even through the sadness and the hard times, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. There is something out there that you can grasp and pull for yourself. It doesn't have to be handed to you when you're in the dumps. I mean, sometimes angels appear, right? But
yeah,
I also think you have to look for your angel and actively seek them out, or find the tools that are going to get you where you want to go.
Yes, yes. And same goes with writing your book. So you are living this life and the kids are growing up and, you know, becoming more independent, and you choose to start writing this all down and forming it into a book. And just like everything else, you gave it your all and you persevered, and, you know, it was hell or high water. You were going to get this book out into the world. So what was that like, to stay committed without fully knowing what the future would hold for the book?
Yeah, that's the worst part, I think, of being a writer and thinking, like we've been talking about, going, okay, I'm not just going to write it, but I'm going to get it published. I'm going to get it out there. And when I started it, I was trained as a food scientist and a counselor. So I have words, of course, but I had no idea how to write.
Yeah.
And that makes me want to apologize again to you for all that manuscript that was first messy draft. But it was something that I've journaled all my life. So I had a lot of good research and I could go back and go, oh, my mom said that or stepdad did that. But in a journal, you don't worry about narrative or point of view or structure or yes. any of the elements of writing. And I really didn't know how to do it. So I looked for a place to learn, and Story Studio was right in my neighborhood where I lived in Chicago. And I took class after class after class. And then I went to retreats, you know, and went outside of Story Studio. And then the pandemic happened and all these online classes that I wasn't even aware of, you know, and just kept on trying and writing and refining and figuring out that I was getting better at it. So, you know, that's a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy in a way when you're like, oh, I can read this draft and then see 5 drafts later, it's actually somewhat good.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, wow. I mean, I'll never forget sending my brother, who is not the most emotional person. He's a mechanic. Yeah. I always say he got the numbers, I got the words.
Yes. Yeah.
And there was a piece I wrote about my great-grandmother teaching me how to make apple pie.
Oh, I remember and that piece. Yeah.
When my brother read it, he wrote back, he goes, yeah, I liked it. It made me emotional.
You're like, done. I don't have to do anything else.
That must mean I'm pretty good if I can get my big brother to feel emotions. But yeah. And it wasn't a linear line like I wrote every day or anything. I mean, you know, life definitely interrupted me at times.
Yeah.
Taking care of the kids, or I did go back to work at certain times. And so I feel like I wrote that huge, messy draft by 2015. We adopted the kids in 2012. So about 3 years later, I had this really bad draft. And I spent like 2 years, I'd say, just trying to write the first chapter, figuring out, okay, if this is going to be where we start, it has to be really good to draw people in. And I think my first chapter, I probably did 25 drafts of that thing.
Oh, yeah.
And then I just realized, I don't know how to do this. And that's right around the time I met you. And I just felt like, she's going to get me and she's going to help me and we're going to do this, Nadine. And so when you said you would help me, you know, you'd coached me, that was really an awesome experience. And it's like your hopes kind of ebb and flow, I think. And that was a high point where I'm like, okay, I'm in it. You know, I'm rewriting, I'm editing, I'm doing the things. And then some stuff happens, you know, life during the pandemic. There are lots of crises in our family. And so I kind of had to put it away for a while too. And then I was looking for an agent, and no agent wants to buy a memoir now unless we're somebody famous, which I'm not. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I kept going. And then at a certain point I'm like, okay, I think I'm going to try a different coach because I can't seem to get another better draft out of myself.
Yeah.
So I worked with Brooke Warner from She Writes Press, and that was also how, once we were done, I kind of put it out there as the person who asks for what you want. And if you don't get it, oh, well. But I said, hey, do you think She Writes would publish my book?
Yes.
And she's like, well, I don't see why not. You know, I know how good it is.
Yes.
So, yeah, I found my publisher by finding a coach who worked there.
Yes.
And it really came together. And then, you know, it's like, oh my gosh, this is going to be published. So it has to be perfect. So then I really did not like that, you know, the proofreading and the constant track changes going back and forth. So then, just a couple months ago, I came home from a trip and there was a box waiting for me and I opened it up and my book was inside it. And I mean, I don't know if this is how you feel when a baby comes out of you and they hand it to you the first time and you're kind of like, oh, this is what I've been waiting for, you know?
It's such a moment. My God. And that's the thing, I think, for all writers, follow that tug of curiosity, that attention, like, oh, I really want to write about this thing. I don't know why, but I really want to. Keep at it. But the main thing is finding your allies, finding your people, finding the team that will support you.
Yeah.
And that's how any of this happens. It does not happen in a vacuum. It happens by just finding the people who can support you at every different step along the way. And there will be multiple people who will, you just kind of start mm-hmm. veering towards them and you go, I don't know why I feel a pull to them, but I'm going to go there and, yeah. and see where this can bring me. And then, okay. And then the next phase, I'm going to go over here and see where it brings me. And then before you know it, here you are with the yeah. book in your hands.
And before I know it, I'm in Maine recording an audiobook too, because that's another thing that happened because of yeah. you. You know, I was in a class. I met our wonderful producer, Michelle Rado. Yeah. And I would never have done an audiobook without her. I mean, I just yeah. never would have. So yes, it takes a village, even though it's very solitary at times. Yeah. It really does. And
yeah.
and to answer that pull of curiosity, as you so beautifully put it.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah.
But you use that same sort of tenacity that you had with running and with everything else, where it's just that question your mom asked it. If you can do this, what else can you do? Mm-hmm. And that's the question for all of us as we're moving forward in our writing careers, our writing hobby. It's like, okay, and then the next little bit and the next little bit. We don't have it all figured out right from the get-go. None of us knows where this is going to lead. We just follow the breadcrumbs. Yeah. And so I think the biggest last question to come out of all of this is we've talked about legacy. We've talked about motherhood. Mm-hmm. What do you think your mom would say to you about this beautiful milestone, my friend?
My mom used to always say, she would tell me, and I would be like, what does this mean? You can do anything, Betsy. You could do anything. She was such a positive, happy person, and always for herself, kind of striving. And she showed me that, you know, she had that perseverance in her own way too. But I think that she would be so proud of me. I mean, I have friends who knew her who have read the book and have said, like, I think your mom would love this, even though there's a lot of hard parts, you know, that were when she was married to my stepdad. And that would be hard for her because she probably would not want to air the family dirty laundry. But I think overall she'd be absolutely beaming with happiness that I did this thing that I couldn't have run a marathon that took me 12 years. I couldn't. There's not many things I could have stuck with for 12 years, but somehow I did for this. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of what makes it sweeter is just like, you're like, wow, I did a really hard thing. Mm. And here it is. Like, look at what we can do. It's incredible. You know?
Well, there's this beautiful scene that I'll never forget where when things were hard between your mom and stepdad, oftentimes the two of you, you and her, would go in the car and you would drive and go to near this airport and you would watch the planes take off. And Betsy, when you sent me the arc, the galley proof of your book, I had this teary-eyed visual and I just imagined you and your mom in planes side by side, just taking off together. I was amazed and so proud. And I thought, man, if I'm this proud, I know her mother is too.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. Those are very poignant scenes for me, and me watching the planes take off and leave and her always focusing on the ones that came home. It's interesting that you brought up planes because now, you know, I'm a snowbird and I live in Vegas part-time in the winter, and I swim every day, and there's a military base not far. And these, the planes, the jets are just zooming over my head and leaving the jet trails. And I look up and I'm just like, hey, mom, I feel like you're there. She's like, hey, mom, here I am all these years later, And it does. It just feels like, yeah, like she would be happy and she's dropping her little, positive reinforcement like she always did here and there in my life. And the planes are part of it.
I am so happy for you. I am so grateful for this conversation. I am delighted for this book to be in the hands of readers that it will impact. I have loved just witnessing your journey as a writer, as a human. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Well, it has been a blast to be a part of your community and to learn from you. You are so wise, and it's been such a pleasure to talk with you again today. It's just, and it's funny because I feel like I've watched you for quite a while too. I could say the same thing. I'm like, I got your last book. It came in the mail. And I just remember thinking, oh my gosh, Nadine wrote another book. This is so cool. So yeah, it's been so fun to watch you and to watch you become the mom you are now. And talk about how happy you are settled in the life that you've made for yourself, really, and going to get Gio at school. And, you've become a different kind of mom and a different kind of human over the years, too. And it's been such a joy to watch you ride around in an Airstream and then find your place. All the things. You've been on a journey. We all are. But yeah. I love how I've been a part of yours, in a small way.
Yeah, I do find that all of us women, there's something about this stage. There's a reawakening that happens. And I love that your book chronicles it all. Awesome. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Dear listeners, you must go grab your copy of The Mother of All Decisions. It is on Amazon and wherever books are sold.
Thank you, Nadine. Oh, I love you.
Oh, man, I was teary-eyed at the end of that conversation. I think it's just really beautiful to see the deep admiration that Betsy and I have for each other. And for Michelle, my dear producer, who produced Betsy's audiobook, this just reminds me again and again how much I am made better because of being in the company of female creatives. It is my life's work to cheerlead and cheer on other women, and I feel very lucky that other women are supporting me and cheering me on as well. So thank you to Betsy, and thank you to my dear producer, Michelle Rado. And thank you to you, dear listener, for coming back time after time to be part of these conversations. Your support means the absolute world to me. And if you want any more of this goodness, you can find me over on Substack. The link is in the show notes. Remember, everyone, every heart has a story, and every story has a heart. See you next time.